I just wanted to say that, you know, whenever you do a film, that it's, you can only do it if you get the cash. And there's a whole bevy of people that are supportive when you're in the Canadian funding structure of making a documentary. For our film, we had National Film Board of Canada, who is also distributing the film, Telefilm Canada, BC Film or British Columbia Film, Saskatchewan Communication Network, TV Ontario, Knowledge Network, Van City Communications, Van City, the bank, and Life Network. So it was just that's what takes the time is raising the money.
And if you're interested in getting this film, what was that number again?
Oh, if you're interested in getting a copy, it's actually being distributed by the National Film Board, and the number is 1-800-267-7710.
Okay.
It's 1-800-267-7710.
And I guess to note out there to young or newly emerging filmmakers, I guess the key you mentioned earlier is just getting works behind you and that might help, and getting to know people that helps find your funding sources.
Yeah, it's doing your research, having a really clear idea of what your film is going to be about, and then really doing your homework on which particular broadcaster does what. So, if your film is more suited for an educational broadcaster like Knowledge Network, or whether it's more suited for CTV, understand what their place is. And CBC News World again has another strand, Witness. You know, it's really important to do that, and it's worth your weight in gold to do your homework on it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's really important to pursue your own sort of interests as well, right?
Well, all the films that Teresa and I have done, we've chosen subjects that really come from the heart for us. Things that, because you have to spend over a year on the thing. Like, it's, it doesn't go away. And you have to continue, if you're producing it, you have to continue to, like we did, our first film we did together is called Teen Rebel, Teen Mom, and we looked at teenage pregnancy. And I just, this week we just got a new distributor on that. So I'm still working on that film, even though we did that film in 1992, I think it was.
And that movie was about?
In that film, we followed four young women from Vancouver and talked to them about their choices. We looked at the planned teenage pregnancy and the link between abuse and teenage pregnancy. And we talked to them about their lives of the time, how life was leading up to the time that they got pregnant, and about their childhood, and about how it was after. All the women in the film had little girls, just by coincidence, and they were all, all their girls were between the ages of 2 and 4. So, it was a very, I learned a lot from those women. It was an incredible experience to spend a year with them and find out their perspective on life. And they still come in and see us. You know, we go for lunch.
That's really unique.
Yeah.
They're very interesting.
Yeah, it's great. I care about them a lot. Yeah. So, and it's great to see what they're doing and see the kids grow up and, you know.
Right.
So as a filmmaker, in documentary anyway, you really develop relationships with the people in your film. The next one we did was called A Rough Crossing on the British kids that came over during World War II, which my mom was one of. So that came from my background. And, you know, we got Christmas cards from all those people are in there. 60s and 50s, 60s and 70s who were, 60s and 70s really in the film. And so we went from spending time with people who were 19 and 20 for a year to people who were 60s and 70s. And the difference, what I find really interesting by doing that is that I think in our culture right now, we tend to spend time with people who are the same age as us. And the people who are the same age as us don't often challenge us very much on our points of view and our attitudes. We kind of just tend to agree with each other a lot, you know? But if you spend time with someone who's much older than you or much younger than you, they definitely have a very different perspective, and they do challenge you all the time, you know.
They have a lot of wisdom and life experiences, and sometimes when we just rely on our interaction as the only older parent, as our parents being the only older people in our life, we really miss out.
It was a very interesting film to do, and we looked at the Canadian policies as to why the British children were brought over here. And we looked at the policies of why Britain sent the kids. My mom was put on a boat at 7 and sent to a family that she'd never met, and she ended up staying with for 5 years because they thought there was going to be a landed invasion of Hitler, which, of course, luckily didn't happen to Britain, but there was a tremendous fear that that was going to happen. And she went back at age 11 and had to be practically introduced to her mother.
Reassimilated,
and she was this little Canadian kid. So,
how many children were brought across from Britain?
6,000.
And were they sort of like?
Approximately, yeah.
Was there any selection process of how they arrived at these 6,000 children?
There was some. Well, there was three different groups. There was a thing called the Children's Overseas Reception Board, which was set up by the British government. Then there was schools. They brought whole schools over that went to Canadian schools. Then there was private evacuees. Like, my mother was private. So, pardon me, what that would mean is my grandfather had organized for her to come and stay with a business acquaintance that he knew. Mm-hmm. And so that would be set up that way. Whereas the Children's Overseas Reception Board was parents put their children forward and they were selected or on a waiting list.
Wow. And was there a cost involved with doing that, or how did it?
There was a cost, not very much.
Okay. So it was sort of available for all British families that their
when France fell is when the panic started. And so people who had cash and connections got their kids out.
Right, okay.
And then there was an uproar and saying, well, how come all these, you know, basically it was elitist.
Yeah.
So that's when they formed the Children's Overseas Reception Board, which was supposed to be for all children.
Okay.
But we also looked at what happened in Vichy, France, with the Jewish children that were waiting in Europe trying to get to Canada. And our Canadian government, Minister of Immigration at the time, F.C. Blair, did everything to block that happening. And those children didn't come. They went back to Auschwitz.
Very frightening.
Very frightening, yeah. So, every subject that you do has challenges in it.
It's like doing a master's degree. Incredible.
It really is.
Which is amazing. You get to do this continual learning process and incredible encounters with people.
Yeah, it is like doing a master's thing. And, you know, it's the type of thing you do. Like, we do quite one-hour documentaries, so it's quite a period of time. It's a continually learning process all the time. Always learning new things.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Let's go back to, we had in a past conversation, we touched on the subject of menstrual extraction, and you were telling me that this is something available to women really in the U.S.
There's a group in the United States who started actually in the 70s when they had... started with the whole mirror and speculum and women looking at their cervix for the first time and getting into groups. And I think it was kind of a takeoff on it and Fried Green Tomatoes with Kathy Bates. But they decided that one of the things that women need to do to empower themselves is to actually understand their bodies. And we're not encouraged to do that. And because male organs are on the outside, it's pretty easy for them to see how they work. But for us, it's all internal. So what they did is they started to mark down their cycle and look at extracting. It was an early abortion technique, so that right now, if you have to get an abortion through legal ways, your body goes through a lot of changes before you're actually eligible to have an abortion. Your breasts change, you know, you go through a hormonal cycle of change, because I think it's 3 weeks, is it, or something? It's something like that before you can actually have an abortion. So what they did is they came up with this technique called menstrual extraction, so that if you're a day or two late with your period, or even a day late, you can just pump it out. You can just pump your period out, and whether you're pregnant or not is kind of irrelevant. You just bring on your period, and you can actually remove your entire period through this process in half an hour, and then that's it. It's done.
Which I think would, for many women, offers an incredible option for them that they would be happy to have, rather than having to go through 5 days of wearing pads.
And they made the kits from just using a fruit jar to actually, you know, like a canning jar to put the actual blood in, and you know, just devise this thing from, so that anyone could make their own kit. And what they did, you couldn't give yourself an extraction, but they got together in groups and they teach each other how to extract, so that they know each other's cycles, they know how their uterus sits, they know everything about each other's bodies. And if you're running late on your period, then your friends come over and give you an extraction. And it's happening, apparently, like all over the states.
But not up here.
Underground groups. It might be happening here. I don't know. I haven't met anyone here who's doing it. But and what they were saying is that because women are, you know, like there's the whole thing of, if you go to a clinic, you've got all those anti-abortion groups, and that's very taxing on your emotional state. This way, you can do this in the privacy of your own home.
And it's safe.
You can do it at your own pace. It's safe, and it doesn't cost anything. And you don't have to tell anyone you're doing it. And they just see it as incredible freedom thing.
But yeah, isn't that how it should be? Women in control of their own bodies.
Yeah, that's what they believe. So that's not in our film, because we didn't have time to include that.
Do we have a name for the group or anything, like if for women wanting more information?
The Federation of the Women's Health Collective would know how to get a hold of information about it.
What about actually something on the internet too? Would there be anything?
I haven't looked at that. It's the Federation of the Feminist Health Collectives, yeah.
Feminist, and is that in the States?
It's in the United States, yeah.
San Francisco, perchance?
California.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll be going down there in a few weeks, so maybe.
Yeah. Well, it's you know, and the other thing they were saying is, why isn't this being used in a lot of countries where it's very hard for women to get any kind of birth control? You know, like this could be something that could be really utilized and is cost effective. And we have this ability to do this in our hands, you know.
But is it because of that same old adage that it's not making anybody any money?
No, it's because it comes back to doctors are the only ones who should be administering that kind of procedure. on a body. It's like it's a health concern.
But in many parts of the world, their doctors aren't.
I know
women are having.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that's why they have had a lot of issues around that. But when I went to meet these women for the first time, this is kind of embarrassing, but they were talking about the clitoris to us and how it actually, when it swells up, it's actually internally, it's the same size as a penis.
Internally,
inside your body, the clitoris. Because I'm saying it's embarrassing for me that I didn't know that, because I just thought it was this little thing at the end. It's like this little tip. They said, well, no, that's the tip of it, but it's actually this huge organ that's inside you, and it swells up with blood, the same size as a man. So it's just that it's internalized. But you're not taught that. You don't know that in your
that's not taught in physiology, no.
No. So, you know, like they're saying, even our medical textbooks and stuff are revisionist.
There's a lot that medical doctors do not know still about women. Well, there's a lot that women really... We have this lack of information about our own bodies.
Yeah.
It's incredible, but... And the number of misdiagnoses that have happened for women is, I think, it's going to go off the walls until we perhaps have better research in the area. Or more.
Well,
the
things that I find frightening right now are endometriosis, for instance. You know, what's happening with that. Breast cancers, just... I have a friend who actually just got that.
It's all of us are all of us are encountering a huge amount of women who are experiencing a chronic disease, mm-hmm. or something of very serious nature, such as breast cancer, interstitial cystitis, irritable bowel syndrome, mm-hmm. endometriosis. It's just mm-hmm. what's going on.
Yeah, we've really we've just got to be okay to talk about it. You know, I think that's the first step. As soon as you can talk about it, then you can do something about it. But if you can't, if you feel so ashamed about a lot of these things that you don't even feel comfortable talking about it, you know, then that's hard. You know, and that's what I've found from a lot of the women that we met during, and men too, who are working in this area, that you can't be afraid to talk about things, you know. You just can't. There's too much going on, so.
And you have to be really believing in your own. Some women, if they get the courage to speak about it, they might encounter in the medical field someone who negates their beliefs about what is truly happening, or negates their symptoms, mm-hmm. and puts it down to more of a hysteria or a psychological in nature, and not really, if per se the tools that they're using can't readily identify a disease, they can't name it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know too much about that. I just think that we've really got to a point where we're not talking about a lot of things in our culture. You know.
Yeah, but we seem to know so much, don't we?
Yeah. And it's always a learning process, but yeah.
Any reasons why we're not talking?
No, I don't really know why. I think this new film we're doing, which is on women artists, I met with a woman the other day who's a curator, and she said that in the 70s women had, you know, from this is her perspective on the feminist movement, that you know, even with the suffragettes and the 70s movement, women knew specifically what they wanted. And they, whether or not they got it or not, they had an agenda and they had what they were fighting. And they knew what they were fighting for. And she said, young women today, I don't know what they're fighting for. Like, I don't know if they know, if they've set a clear set of goals anymore. Like, the line seems so fuzzy. And she said what she felt was happening is that most artists are actually... working in isolation, and that you know, we're not working together in groups anymore. We're not getting together in community staff, you know, like we're all kind of working on our own, and we don't have an agenda. So I thought that was quite interesting. You know, I don't know what the agenda right now for, well, I think feminism is a whole, it's a whole other thing. And that's kind of what I'm looking at right now. I'm looking at, there's a group in Toronto I just interviewed, and they have a magazine which is called Matriarch. And they were told from their distributor that they had to take the word feminism out of the title in order to sell it. So it really has become the F word, you know. And
strange.
Yeah.
But hopefully, you know, there's actually quite a lot of young females that are putting out different zines and whatnot. And
oh, I'm sure. I know there is a lot going on, and I really welcome. I'd really like to get to know more about that. I don't know very much about what's going on right now with younger women. I think whenever you have the sort of revolution, you have to question it. There's always an assessment period, and I think we're in that assessment period. But I think we still got a whole long way to go, you know.
We do. But hopefully we'll get there together.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
So let's say Under Wraps is going to be showing in Vancouver area on Knowledge Network April 29th. And we've given the number if you're interested in purchasing the film. You can get it through the National Film Board of Canada. And then it's going to be showing on different days following that in other parts of Canada?
It's going to be on TV Ontario on the 30th of April at 10 a.m. And it's going to be in Saskatchewan on Saskatchewan Communication Network on May 7th at 10 a.m. And it's going to be aired, it's going to have a screening in Toronto, which I'm excited about. We're nominated for Best Cultural Documentary at Hot Docs. So going out to, Teresa McInnes, the director, and I are going out to introduce that. So that'll be fun.
Mm-hmm. And it should win because it definitely deserves it.
Well, thanks for that. We got a lot of strong competition, but it's just nice to be in a place where we can have a screening. It's great.
It's wonderful. It's a great film, and I encourage everyone to watch this or get a copy of it. Maybe we'll see it at Rogers Media one day.
You never know.
You never know. I think that's it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming in, Penny.
Okay.
Great.